and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. On this week's show, we've booted out the boys and have welcomed in a whole host of ladies into the pod as we celebrate women in technology. Joining me today are regular Jemima Kish, The Guardian's new media correspondent. You're not regular, by the way, just that's you are a regular.
I'm irregular.
You're quite odd, actually. Emily Bell, the director of digital content at The Guardian, and Sue Sharman Anderson, social media consultant and founder of Ada Lovelace Day, which we will be discussing later on in the pod. So welcome to you all. Thank you very much for coming in from your various busy lives. Emily, you were saying you've been playing with Spore recently.
Trying to play with Spore because my 8-year-old's demanding an upgrade to Leopard, which because we have Croc technology. So at the moment I'm engaged in a long-term Guitar Hero battle with him. Sorry, I'm just trying to prove that I know something about technology.
You aren't.
But Spore is the future. No, actually it's the now.
I was just discussing with somebody recently about using Spore to create biology simulations for classrooms.
I think that would be a very good idea. Have you got very far with that, Alex?
I know. It was somebody else's project. I just went, oh, yes, that sounds good.
I think it's your project now.
It is. Oh, it's on my shoulders. They're so heavy. Jemima, what have you been playing around with?
I've been fiddling with a netbook, Samsung NC10. I've only used it for a few hours so far, but yeah, it is very small and very light. The small screen is the biggest bugbear at the moment, but it's very fast. I'm quite impressed so far.
And Sue, welcome to the pod.
Thank you.
What have you been playing with this week?
I've actually been doing stuff that's a lot less exciting than Spore and netbooks. I've been getting into usability testing. So I've been playing with a Silverback app, which does a sort of records your screen and records video of you or someone else testing applications.
Three very different types of technology that we have around this table. I've been just exploring airplane technology. I've been, unfortunately, sorry, planet Earth, been flying. But on today's show, we're here, based back in Britain, we're celebrating the women who create and who consume digital technology, from its early beginnings to the innovators of the future. We're also speaking with the boy, yes, the boy geniuses behind the Guardian's Developer Network, launched today. And in keeping with tradition, we're discussing all the latest news and your views from the blogs. So stick around for the next 30 minutes of debate and discussion from Tech Weekly. If the vision you have in your head of computer programmers is as soft, pasty men, you may be surprised to know that the very first computer programmer was in fact a woman. Her name was Ada Lovelace. To celebrate Lovelace's hidden influence on the contemporary computing industry, we've invited Sue to come in and let us know what's going on with Ada Lovelace Day. Sue, what's the story here?
Ada Lovelace Day is an international day of blogging about women in technology, and it was born from actually years of conversations, primarily after big tech conferences, where people would say, where were all the women speakers at these tech conferences? And looking at the landscape, there just doesn't seem to be so many women as there are men. And I started talking to some friends of mine about, you know, maybe doing something, and started reading up on some of the issues around women in technology, and came across a paper about how women needed female role models more than men need male role models, and just thought, well, you know, that's actually something we can start to address quite easily, because, you know, what is a role model? Role models are just someone that you know about that you admire. So I just thought if we get a few people to blog about women in technology that they admire, then we'd all have some names to talk about and get some idea of the breadth of knowledge and experience out there.
So how did you land upon Ada Lovelace? How did you find this quite extraordinary woman?
She was suggested to me as a sort of role model for the day by a friend of mine, Kevin Marks. She was really the first computer programmer. She was Lord Byron's daughter, and her mother, Anne Milbank, decided that rather than let her daughter become infected by poetry, that she would ensure that her daughter was trained fully in maths and science and other such logical pursuits. So she became a mathematician at a time when it wasn't really the done thing for women to do that sort of thing. She was born in 1815. And she ended up being friends with Charles Babbage, who, of course, designed and built one of the first ever computers. She actually wrote the first computer program. So when you're thinking of computer programs as manipulating symbols in order to achieve an outcome, she wrote a program to produce Bernoulli numbers. And she was one of the first people, way more than her peers, to actually see a computer as something that could be creative. She foresaw computers being used in music and for graphics at a time when even people like Babbage just saw them as ways to do very complicated maths.
Now, in your search, in your sort of exploration around this day, searching for various interesting women in technology, are there any that have stood out for you that you've thought, wow, didn't know about this woman before, didn't realize her impact?
People like Grace Hopper, who was a military programmer.
Invented Centipede.
Indeed, and has had a massive influence on the industry.
Emily, when I asked you this very question before, who do you admire in technology? You looked terrified.
Yes, and a bit baffled. And then I thought about my own experiences where occasionally people ring me up and ask me to speak at something, which is clearly too, because I'm not a woman in technology, I'm a woman in journalism, but I'm at the sort of tech end, I suppose, of journalism. And my first thought is always, couldn't you get Esther Dyson? Because that, again, is the sort of the there are so few women who are actually out there talking about it. But I think, as Sue says, that there are a number of women. I think particularly sort of, you know, interestingly on the applications of technology, and I think that's sort of something that we will see much more of, which is actually, you know, getting slightly away from the code and talking about the social implications of it. And I think that, you know, when you look at, I'm now not going to be able to remember a single name, but places like, you know, the Berkman Center for Internet and Society, actually, there's some really kind of fabulously talented female researchers there doing very, very good work. You know, we have a marvelous head of community social media here, Meg Pickard, who does lots of speaking at conferences. And, you know, there are a lot of kind of very inspirational women. It's just that you don't tend to get to see them. And I think that that's because, again, you know, Sue says that it's shaming, really, that we all ought to know more about this, if you like, the sort of the role of the gender, the role of our gender within technology than we actually do.
Jemima, do you think, though, that this is a place that we should start talking about positive discrimination, that we should start bringing women into these positions more often?
Well, I mean, that's a really contentious subject, isn't it? Whether, I mean, I write, I suppose, half about media and half about technology, and I've never felt a need to say, I'm a woman and this is what I write about. I just, it doesn't actually affect what I do. And I think that's the same, you know, if you're in development or engineering or, you know, any of those areas. It doesn't actually affect the work you do. I suppose the important thing are to have kind of campaigns just to make women aware that there are opportunities available. And a lot of companies, including most recently Google, have a sort of an annual day where they try and promote careers for women in engineering and things. And you have to kind of pitch it carefully, because you can't just take someone on just because they're a woman. They have to be good.
Well, undoubtedly, there is something about, you know, educational standards, and kind of it's something to do with kind of gender conditioning and how people feel. What again, sort of peer approval from women about the kind of subjects. But that's surely gone now. I mean, I think that sort of, you know, there are enough eminent female mathematician scientists. I mean, unfortunately, one of them obviously is Dr. Susan Greenfield, who's just told us that, you know, the internet rewires your brain, which probably hasn't helped.
Gloss over that.
Yeah, it's under the carpet.
So I think that we do have a Women in Technology program. Even actually at the Guardian, where we have, I think, done some really good works within the IT department to make sure that sort of our best. You know, unfortunately, what tends to happen is you can get you know, fantastic women in your IT department. They get picked off very, very quickly. We sort of lose a lot of them, oddly, because other organisations are looking for that sort of expanded view. Because I do think, one thing I do think is that women do have a broader view. Actually, the women in this area, I think, have been extremely kind of creative about how they think about technology.
I think I agree. You know, when we talk about technology and women in technology, the temptation is to think about coding ninjas. And how many female coding ninjas do we know? And that's actually, I think, the definition of technology is much broader than that. And once you start to get away from the coding ninjas question, you start to see a lot more women in the application of technology. So I think it appeals to women's sort of social side. So I do see, you know, a lot more women in fields like social media, like usability. But I think I'm not convinced that we've gotten past that point where we can relax and say that, yes, you know, women get the same opportunities. Because I think there's a difference between opportunity and the confidence to go for an opportunity. And certainly, you know, anecdotal warning ahead. In amongst my friends, the key thing seems to be not a lack of skills, but a lack of confidence, that women feel a little bit more reluctant to go head-to-head with guys when they're going for either a promotion or for jobs, or even to put themselves forward to speak at conferences. Because I think there's just a sense of like, well, maybe I'm just not as expert as I think I am. And that's why I want to see us talking about the women that we admire.
Leah Culver is a sort of Silicon Valley developer who worked on Pounce and a few other things. And at South by Southwest last year, there was a panel about self-promotion and blogging and things. And she said, women just don't pimp their shit. Men pimp their shit all the time on their blogs, or they go on TV. They're really good at doing it. Women just don't like pimping their shit.
Well, we are pimping. Our shit has been pimped.
We're mad pimping. Yeah.
And as a woman named Alex, I'd like to say that I'm out there representing as well. I should start going by Alexandra, really. Anyway,
I was
going to
say, people just think you're a bloke.
Yeah, they do, actually.
Despite that.
Even though there's a picture.
Even though there is a picture.
Just think I have been called a man recently. But anyway, we won't go into that.
That's all right, because people think Bobby Johnson's a girl sometimes.
That's true. So we've just swapped identities.
There's no one who's met him.
Well, thank you very much, Sue. So it's on the 24th of March is Ada Lovelace Day. Mm-hmm. Where can they find out a bit more?
Findingada.com, or you can sign the pledge. We want as many people as possible to write a blog post or do a video or even just Twitter. And that pledge is at pledgebank.com/Ada Lovelace Day.
Thank you very much. You can see all those links on our webpage, which is guardian.co.uk/techweekly. Now here's Jemima with the news.
Chicago police are trying to ban ads for erotic services on Craigslist after accusing it of being the single largest source of prostitution in the US. Authorities filed a $100,000 federal lawsuit alleging that an FBI study had found 2,800 child prostitution ads on the site. Craigslist charges $5 per ad but donates the proceeds to charity. An increasing number of renegade iPhone software businesses are challenging Apple, the latest being an entire rival software store. The Cydia store could sell hundreds of apps, all designed to work on jailbroken iPhones. London-born physicist Stephen Wolfram is preparing to launch a new search engine that he claims will rival Google. Wolfram Alpha is based on natural language processing, understanding questions posed by users, and should launch in May. Social networking is more popular than web-based email, new research by Nielsen has found, with around 10% of our web time spent on various member communities. Facebook saw 168% growth from December 2007 to December 2008, while MySpace dropped 3%, though none of the big three networks even made a dent in China or Japan, where domestic networks rule.
Jemima, can we just quickly stop on the social networking issue? Now you say that it's you say that it's bigger than email. Isn't the web-based mail issue, isn't the fact that, you know, Facebook and MySpace have usurped web-based mail to do with the fact that they're also that they're email clients as well, that they have a really successful email feature?
Well, yes, it's we're not talking about things like Outlook. We're talking about Hotmail and things. So obviously people are using Facebook and MySpace instead. I mean, that just reinforces that these platforms are essentially communication platforms and not publishing platforms, as media companies often tend to assume. But it's not very good for MySpace, this research. I did notice, actually, anecdotally, I was listening to Radio 1 last night, and they said, send in your questions through Facebook or Bebo. And no MySpace. That's interesting. No MySpace, yeah.
That's sort of a death knell, isn't it?
Yes, it's not what the youth are doing. But yes, a time spent on Facebook shot up. It went up by something like 566% or something obscene over that year-long period when they did the research. And MySpace, again, sort of slumped a bit. So, I mean, that's the key trend from this. But still, if you look at what is now the world's biggest internet market, which is China, they don't even mention, they're not even in the top 10, Facebook, Bebo or MySpace. They don't even make a show, and in Japan as well, because these companies didn't think about moving into those markets until too late. There are so many companies there you've never heard of. 51 in China is the biggest. And this long string of social networking sites you've never heard of that are enormous. And Mixi in Japan and loads of others. But
these social networks in Japan and China and the various other regions, they've focused on mobile. Mixi in particular is very much focused on mobile. And I'm wondering if, because the mobile element hasn't really been situated quite so deeply in this country and in the US and in various other regions, is this perhaps a reason why we're seeing such a disparity between here and there?
Well, definitely. And also the fact that MySpace and Facebook are essentially they are American, and Americans are behind, well, certainly even behind us in terms of the development of their mobile services. And so, yes, Japan, certainly, and Korea as well, obviously, they're way ahead of us in mobile. It's the next big thing. Location-based services are going to be absolutely vast, and I wonder really if Facebook and MySpace and Bebo are going to be able to do enough to innovate in this space, or if someone else is going to come in.
Speaking of mobile, Sue, I noticed that you access the web via your mobile handset. Mm-hmm. Do you use Google for searches? Is this your search engine of choice?
Yeah, it still is. I mean, every now and again, I do try and find other search engines, because it gets a bit scary how reliant on Google you become. You know, you have Gmail and Google Documents and Gcal, but then you look at the other search engines and they're just not very good.
Shall
I'm
I tell
afraid.
You how reliant on Google we are? Well, according to some data from Net Applications that came out last week, 97.5% of mobile search is through Google. I should point out, though, that 66% of the people that they surveyed were using iPhones, and obviously Google is the default search on that. But even so, if you're Yahoo with a 2.03% market share, it can't be that happy, can it?
You can read up on all these stories and more at guardian.co.uk/technology. The Guardian's Developer Network launched today, opening up the Guardian's journalism to you, the consumer, for tinkering, mashing up, and generally messing around with our content. Jemima spoke with the brains behind the project to find out what exactly you can do with our APIs.
The Guardian hopes the launch of its open platform will be a new window into its journalism. In a moment, I'll be speaking to two of the developers behind the project, but first I spoke to Kevin Anderson, the Guardian's digital research editor, and asked him to explain exactly what a developer network involves.
Well, a platform, and in this case, really, there are two elements to this. There's the API, the application programming interface, and that's just, I mean, in layman's terms, it's an easy way to take our content and reuse it on other sites and services. The other part of it that is actually a little bit novel is something called the data store, and that is sets of data. It might be environmental data, population data, economic data, data about US or UK casualties in Iraq. And we make it available in a format that other people can download and use. And the value in that, at least as seen from The Guardian, is that this is actually curated, collected by our editors. So we kind of, if you will, put a Guardian stamp of approval.
So there's been a trend in the technology industry for sites and services to kind of open themselves up for a while. To what extent are news organizations starting to do this online?
Well, there are several news organizations that are doing this. The BBC launched its Backstage Network, which is a developers network, in 2005, and they have summary feeds of their news and sport, some travel information, and the whole idea was, you know, use our stuff to build your stuff. It's positioned a little differently because The Guardian is pitching this a little bit more as a commercial partnership. The New York Times also recently launched, again, something very similar. They've got their Newswire API, which, again, it's a summary feed. It's not the full article feed that The Guardian's producing.
How important is it that journalists understand and begin to use the kind of technology that is available to them through tools like the open platform?
If you look at a service like Twitter, which again has a similar, as Matt McAllister says, ecosystem around it, they get 20 times the traffic through their API that they do through their website. So the API is driving huge amounts of use for Twitter. It's not actually their website, which is the main driver for Twitter use. And I would suppose that that's probably one of the major motivators for The Guardian to launch an API or any news organization. You can have a number of different applications or services built around your content and hopefully drive growth. Now, I think there's an interesting parallel to Twitter in that everyone says, well, yeah, Twitter's great, but how does it make money? But they're working through that and hope to develop an ad network on it. Now, I think there's always been data in our stories, but a lot of times we don't present it in its full form. We leave lots of it on the cutting floor and just present a small story about it. So now you can actually see the numbers that inform our stories. I think for journalism, it's a great transparency exercise. And also when we collect this data, we can actually create visualizations to help us see patterns in a lot of complex activities. Maybe we would have seen more about the financial crisis if we would have interrogated the data a little bit more.
Nearly every department at The Guardian had some sort of input into the developer network, from legal to editorial and production. Behind the scenes, it took 6 months to approve and then 3 months to build. Matt McAllister, head of The Guardian's developer network, and Simon Willison, software architect, both came into the studio to tell me about the project. And I began by asking Matt what the starting point was.
There's a simple model with RSS feeds. I think that's, you know, what kind of kicked it off for me a few years ago. And then when I was working at Yahoo, I saw how some of these things could be done on a much larger scale. So it's kind of just a progression of those kinds of ideas.
Okay, and so tell us what's on offer.
So we're offering what we call the open platform, which is just the collection of services that enable partners to build applications with The Guardian. There's two pieces to that. The first one is the content API, which is the way that we open up our content. And then the other piece is the data store, which is a directory of useful data curated by Guardian editors.
And Simon, part of your job is to, I suppose, play with and build stuff out of all this cool thing. So what's excited you about what's on offer there?
Well, so we've released two things today, the content API and the data store. And the data store is actually, I think, where some of the real surprises are going to come. So with the data store, what happened is we have Simon Rogers, a news editor who collects a lot of the data that we use in our infographics. And so he's been sat for years on this enormous pile of spreadsheets. So with the data store, we've started publishing this stuff on the website in its raw form. He's actually uploading data to Google spreadsheets, which means that we get sort of Google APIs for programmatically accessing that. But people can also export it as Excel files and CSV files and so forth. And the range of data that he's accumulated in just a few weeks for the initial launch is astonishing. I think he has 86 spreadsheets. There are facts and figures on everything from sort of breakdowns of government spending to how healthy we are, how much exercise people are getting. Each of these is an annotated data set. And I think once people truly understand how much data there is that's been released and that this data is going to be updated in the future, there are going to be some really interesting things built on top of it.
Okay, so it's exciting. It's also free. Mm-hmm. How is this going to make money for The Guardian?
The big key for our API is that we're offering full content. We're offering the complete article in the API. And so what we're going to do in the future is look at how we can partner with people to build advertising services around the full content. You can take headlines and you know, basically do whatever you want within the terms and conditions. But the full content is a place where we think there's some interesting advertising opportunities.
And in the future, Simon, it seems like there's so many different directions that this could go off in. Are there any sort of pet projects that you'd really like to work on? You know, particular things we haven't opened yet, but that could be a whole kind of treasure trove of sort of creative ideas?
Well, in terms of data that we hope to release in the future, The Guardian collects an awful lot of interesting political data, MP profiles and things, which is just itching to make it out into the API at some point. And we certainly can't set a date on that, but that's something we're interested in looking at.
So, Matt, I know there's a much larger technology strategy for The Guardian and probably more hack days and all sorts of exciting things. I mean, what's on your to-do list and how does the network get expanded next? And, you know, what exciting things can we keep an eye out for?
The immediate roadmap is kind of based in large part on what people start asking of us. We've already gotten a lot of feedback on what to do with the API, so there's some stuff that we want to look at there. The data store has all kinds of possibilities. Matt Wall previewed some of the work that's going on with an application platform, which allows us to bring third-party development into guardian.co.uk. There's also stuff we need to build around ad services. It's, you know, once you have this platform environment, you start to realize that you're in basically an ecosystem business, and you have to fuel the ecosystem with lots of tools and revenue streams and content. And, you know, there's so much to do. It's just a really exciting place to start this adventure.
Well, this week we're plunging into The Guardian Unlimited's treasure trove for a few tidbits about women and technology. Actually, I'm the only person who's doing that because I'm the only one who got really excited about this. And I also write quite a bit about it on the Games blog. And on the Games blog, historically, we've debated not only the content creators, but also the players of games who are women, with the variety of effects. But throughout the entirety of Guardian Unlimited, it seems that this debate is quite a hot topic. Including this particular comment, or this particular piece that was written just in January by, I think it's Mary Richert. Is it Mary Richert? I don't know if that's how you pronounce her name. But it's called Buy a Wii and the Sex Tips Are Free. And that had to do with the fact that GameStop, which is the world's largest video game retailer, believed that they could get a whole new audience if they gave away subscriptions to Cosmo and to Good Housekeeping. They figured that would encourage women to come and play the games. And this is something that we see again and again and again across technology, whether it's, you know, pink laptops or pink Nintendo DSs. And, oh, God, everybody's eyeballs are rolling around in their head. Yes, Jamal.
Or conversely, on T3 magazine, which the gadgets magazine always has tits and arse on the cover, and I would never read it because of that.
Huh.
They're sort of losing out on an audience.
GoDaddy's Super Bowl ad. Which was basically all tits and ass, and I've cancelled my GoDaddy account because of that.
I hope they're listening.
There you go. That's word on the street. Anyway, Imogen Black commented on this piece, and what she said was, why do retailers think a subscription to Cosmopolitan will convince women to purchase video games? Possibly because the advertising industry relies on stereotyping, and the older stereotypes of women are sadly rather outdated.
Yeah.
And what she says is, I would imagine that Nintendo Wii did some market research on the matter themselves, and which group is probably most likely to respond to market research, she offers, homemakers, who probably enjoy reading Cosmo and Good Housekeeping. So that's her thought. Mm-hmm. Jemima, you've got some feedback from around the blogosphere the web.
I do. From the tech blog, from P Facto, I was interested to hear Charles is looking at newspapers charging for content in the US. In Hong Kong, it's been this way for many years at the leading English daily, the South China Morning Post. Click on a story to find out how to continue reading by subscribing for actual money, scmp.com. There are two other popular English dailies here, The Standard, a free tabloid, and The China Daily, another broadsheet, but originating from the mainland. Both of these offer free access to all stories on their websites. So just some good case studies there for Charles to continue his research. From Facebook, Simon Thurston wrote, "The baby doing the dance was the Ooga Chaka baby." That was from Ali McBeal.
Yeah,
I think. Yeah. I used to love that thing, but it freaked out my girlfriend so completely it was worth doing the dance for her every now and then. Smiley face.
I got quite a lot of Twitter feedback on that. I had a lot of people sending me the original link, and it was really quite horrible to revisit it.
It was just like a really naff computer graphic of a baby in Ali
McBeal.
But
it was so young. It was so new. It was so fresh at that time. Like the hamster dance.
Just one more. A tweet from something I actually can't pronounce. Oh, no, sorry. Flannel Enigma. Sorry, the two words were run together and it really didn't make sense. I found ask.metafilter.com to be an excellent resource when the wisdom of crowds can solve real problems.
Hmm. thoughtful.
Yes.
You can find out more about how to join in the conversation by heading to our website, which is guardian.co.uk/techweekly.
In this Thursday's tech section with The Guardian, we look at a voice stress analysis system which insurance companies and the government say can detect benefit and insurance cheats, but it's never been scientifically validated, and some say it's more like astrology. So has the money just been wasted? We question whether Apple's going to release a netbook. Evidence of new orders to a Chinese manufacturer have raised expectations. As the recession crunches, more companies are turning to free software such as OpenOffice and the GIMP to get work done. And OpenWide, dentists have a whole new technology for making crowns, and it's amazingly accurate. All in Thursday's tech section with The Guardian.
Well, that's it from us. I'd like to thank Emily and Sue, plus our in-pod Potter Jemima. Thanks as well to Scott, our fearless and tireless producer. Now, before we go, Sue, how are the preparations coming for Ada Lovelace Day?
Wonderfully. We are just sort of taking off in the French blogosphere. A friend of mine wrote a French blog post. I can't read French, so I have no idea what she said, but suddenly lots of pingbacks. We have well over 1,000 people on the Facebook event. We have coming up for 1,400 people on PledgeBank. Originally, I thought it would be a bit of a struggle to get 1,000, so it's great to see so many people signing up. But of course, the more the merrier. The more people that join in, the bigger a splash we will make. It's the 24th of March. And I'm very happy to say that we are joining forces with Nesta, and we will be doing some events for women in technology over the summer. So if you want to keep track of all that, it's findingada.com and also twitter.com/findingada.
And of course, you can send in any of your women-themed conferences, events, etc., etc., to both findingada.com and also to tech@guardian.co.uk. On next week's show, Jemima and I are reporting from South by Southwest in Austin, Texas. You can read more on the blog at guardian.co.uk, but in the meantime, I'm Alex Kratowski. Have a great week. We'll